Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Teacher Takeaway Podcast. I'm James Gray, one of your co-hosts, and I'm joined by the lovely Beck West.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
And you are joining us for episode 7. And we're grateful to be joined again by Dr. Nathaniel Swain. And our episode 7 focus is going to be focusing on improving our own writing and writing instruction. Thanks for joining us again, Nathaniel.
It's really nice to be here, James, and thanks, Beck. I'm really looking forward to getting into this discussion.
And I know we were discussing before, last time we had Nathaniel on our podcast, we had Aaron and Alice engaging in the conversation with Nathaniel and looking at our views. It was one of our most popular episodes. So,
that's exciting.
Yeah. So everyone must have loved what, you know, you had to share in the last episode and the conversation that you had with Aaron and Alice. But for those of you who don't know Nathaniel and the work that he does, Dr. Nathaniel Swain's a teacher, instructional coach and writer. He works as a senior lecturer in learning sciences and director of undergraduate academic programs at La Trobe University School of Education and Solar Lab. Nathaniel has taught a range of learners in schools and universities and founded a community of teachers committed to the science of learning, Think Forward Educators. Now, 23,000 members and growing. Dr. Swain is a sought-after speaker on educational circuits and has a new book soon to be released in 2024 entitled Harnessing the Science of Learning, Success Stories to Kickstart Your School Improvement. Quite the resume there, Nathaniel.
It's a bit of a mouthful to get through, isn't it? Sorry about that.
No, I'm really interested I know we're not covering it in this episode, but your new book about harnessing the science of learning, that's, you know, sounds like an interesting topic there.
Had a great time with that, and it is in sort of the production stage at the moment, something to come out later in the year. But what's the best thing about that project so far has been to get stuck into schools and hearing about their experiences and really writing up what they've learned along the way. So it's a very practical book that I'm looking forward to bringing for people to give feedback on as well.
Oh, awesome. Great job there. So our first question tonight, Nathaniel, is why is writing something for teachers to think about?
Well, it's a broad question, but essentially everything that we do in our instruction involves language, and language is has many modalities. There's the oral spoken language, which is more naturally acquired. We've had it for much longer. And then there's the written modality. So when we are thinking about our writing, we're essentially thinking about how we want to manipulate language for different purposes. And teachers that find it easier to craft fantastic writing often find it easier to explain things or to show and to model and to use language to provide instruction or feedback to their students. So writing is not only important because as curriculum makers ourselves, we need to think about how best to frame up and to use the best possible definitions and to give the best explanations for different content that we're trying to teach. But it's also in our everyday use in the classroom. We need to think carefully about the way that we're phrasing things, the way that we're explaining them, which vocabulary we're using depending on the audience, how we're building students' understanding of the common sort of things that we're talking about. So yeah, you can't really avoid writing as a teacher because you're always talking.
Exactly right. And what have you found, I guess, you working in a diverse range of settings, you know, working within schools, then, you know, the work that you're doing currently within universities, how do you find, you know, teachers' efficacy when it comes to writing? Do you feel that they've had, you know, the rich training within their undergraduate course and prior learning at school to have a positive efficacy when it comes to the teaching of writing? Or what's...
That's a great question. And I think it relates as well to how teachers feel about their mathematics ability. So that it's quite varied, just like the maths skills are. I think most primary teachers especially might feel like some of those areas are actually like, oh, I didn't love writing all those essays in year 12, or I didn't love doing maths in year 11, so I dropped it for year 12, whatever it might be. So teachers will come with a broad range of experiences, as we know, and they've got, you know, fantastic strengths in lots of areas, and then other areas that are probably not necessarily a weak point, but something that they're like, oh yeah, I don't really love doing that. I'm going to have to do it because as a generalist primary teacher or as a secondary teacher with lots of things on, you have to do it. So I think, to be honest, I don't think writing has had enough of a focus in secondary education when the teachers are basically finishing off their educational sort of career in secondary sense, but also not in undergraduate or postgraduate study for teaching either. I think writing is sort of like an assumed skill, and many lecturers that I've worked with in the past sort of throw up their hands and say, oh my gosh, goodness, these teaching students don't know how to write. They can't even string a sentence together, whatever it might be. And rather than seeing it, this is actually a pedagogical opportunity. As a teacher of teachers, we actually have, it's our responsibility to ensure that teachers can write, and that the use of language for classroom instruction, but also written expression, all those reports we have to write, all those individualized learning plans we have to write, we're using writing constantly, and we have to not only be good at breaking it down for students, but also writing in a professional sense as well. So yeah, I don't think it has been enough of a focus, because there are so many hacks that you can use as an educator to help you feel better about, you know, being confident with your writing, that you don't have to be in the dark about this is this magical thing that can't ever be improved, because we can all get better at writing.
No, I agree. No, I like the comparison that you made between, you know, the maths connection there, because I've, in my experience as well, I found it very similar, that sometimes obviously how the teacher presents, you know, their passion about whatever subject that it is, we know that it then reflects in the student level of engagement with what it is. But I know that sometimes teachers are worried or anxious with teaching writing, because there's so many different components to it. And I guess depending upon the school and the context that you work with, and what the writing program and the scope and sequence, and then how those skills are explicitly taught, and what, you know, sometimes I feel that some schools get it wrong with not that it's not from a teaching and learning perspective, from a scope and sequence perspective. I think it can be somewhat overwhelming, is what I'm trying to articulate.
And yeah, and it can be overwhelming for our students as well, in terms of them feeling like they know what they need to do to do the writing task that they need to do in, as part of the curriculum. So yeah, teachers can feel like it's a heavy load, and then students can feel that as well. As you said really well there, James, whatever the teacher even subconsciously sort of or unconsciously projects about their feeling about a subject area does get picked up by the students. So if students notice that they don't seem to have as much fun when they get to writing or when they get to maths or whatever it might be, students pick up on that, and it does sort of transfer across. So I think there's a good reason for all teachers to invest in their understanding and sort of really know that getting good at writing is actually an investment for their professional knowledge and also their sense of efficacy as well, as you've said before.
Coming from an industry where we all like to speak in acronyms, that difficulty where we're trying to get our kids to use their best quality language or expression while still being able to excite them about writing at the same time, because in some cases, I guess if we're teaching that explicit model of you know, there's a recipe to this type of writing, there are things that are meant to be in there, things that aren't meant to be in there, but then of course you'll read something like, you know, Aaron Blabey or whatever, where it's just like, you know, all the rules go out the window. we're not meant to start a sentence in the middle of the page, but yet there it is on this particular children's book or something like that. And that can be confusing for the kids, because we're trying to develop this understanding for them. But then the fun part of reading and writing can be that it doesn't follow the rules. So it just gets a bit hectic and challenging. So I guess, like, what do you see as being the common challenges in teacher and student writing?
I think just what you said there, Beck, is really true. Like, you can get overwhelmed by, it seems like everyone's breaking the rules all the time, when you sort of look, you read one book and it does it one way, and you read another text and it does it a different way. But I think the missing piece sometimes is that we don't want to just help students go through the motions to get good at writing a particular kind of text. We actually want them to be able to pick it apart so they can see what's being manipulated, what's being changed here in this particular way, and actually see those patterns. So like you said, like, you know, most texts will start at the top of the page and they'll move down. If students aren't aware of that, then seeing a book with the text right in the middle won't seem unusual. It's like anything goes. But it's those idea of convention. So if you've got an understanding of the conventions of how different texts work and how authors tend to use them, you then can pick up when there's differences and when there's changes. So similar to when a great sports person, for example, gets good at certain plays in their game, whether it's soccer or something like that, they can sort of know this is the way that it usually happens, or this is the way that it looks like. And these are some of the techniques that are required to do a good, now I know nothing about soccer, so watch me embarrass myself, but you know, how to actually execute this move properly. But then if you get really good at it, you start seeing the way that great players don't follow the rules all the time, don't follow those same techniques in a predictable fashion. They actually manipulate and they play and they do unpredictable things, but knowing the rule book and then throw being it allows you to throw the rule book out. You can't throw it out without having learned some of the rules and some of the conventions first. So I don't think it's any different for writing. I think students first and foremost, you know, should be empowered to know that writing begins with just the sentence, like just being able to do a really solid expression of yourself in a complete sentence is so powerful. Some of our students obviously have many different language backgrounds and may not have the rich literacy experiences that show them those conventions in a sort of a developmental sort of way, where they've been reading lots of books before, they've looked at punctuation, they've looked at capital letters, they sort of have an understanding of how things work already. So making that a bit of a focus and saying, well, this is how a sentence works. Every sentence needs a subject and it needs a predicate. Fancy words, but subject is the who of the sentence, predicate is the what of the sentence. What is that person or animal or thing doing? And if you don't have a subject and a predicate, you don't have a sentence. And sentences start with a capital letter, finish with a full stop, and there's heaps of other things that happen in the middle. Many of our students that go to secondary school still haven't got that, which is why there's frustrated year five and year six and year seven teachers read those one sentence essays that appear, you know, where it's a stream of consciousness with not a lot of punctuation or lots and lots of ands and ands and ands and thens. Like, there's a reason for that, because some students haven't yet mastered that concept of when you write things down, you have to break up your sentences into conventional units so that there's a capital letter, a full stop, and it makes it easy for the reader. The other things, obviously, that's the very basic, but it's about building all the complexity on top of that. So understanding that once you've mastered the sense of what a sentence is, like, what are the different kinds of sentences are there? You know, there's descriptive or declarative sentences where you're saying what something is doing, or a simple sort of subject predicate sort of sentence, like James read from the script, for example. But then there's also questions. So you can turn that around to say, did James read from the script? And then there's commands, like James read the script. So in that one, there is no subject. You can just say read the script, and the subject of James can be taken out. And then there's imperatives. There was one more. What have I forgotten? Declaratives, questions, imperatives. Oh, exclamatives. You'd just say James with an exclamation mark, for example, James. So that would be, you know, there's my four sentence types. So if you get a sense of, I guess, all the range of kinds of sentences you can use, because there's not just one kind of sentence. And look, you know, there's a whole scope and sequence that you could go through of all of that stuff. But essentially, you get good at manipulating sentences, and not just simple ones, complex ones, interesting ones, things with subordinate conjunctions, stuff with appositives, which are those great little tools that you can put after a noun to make it more interesting, like James, a podcast host, read from the script. So that little extra bit after James gives us more information, but it's not clunky, it's really elegant. And then obviously you can go from that to, you know, let's write a whole paragraph about James and what he's doing. And it's going to make sense, and it's going to link from one thing to another, and it's going to have a nice, easy to understand structure. And you go from paragraphs to text and so on and so forth. The rest is all the fun and the detail of it. But I think some of those bones there that are there at the beginning, and also teachers' ability to explain those structures and feel confident to say why it is we have to do it a certain way, where does that comma go, and why do we need to avoid a semicolon here, why is it better to do a full stop and let it be, all of those things sometimes are a little bit hit and miss depending on what your background has been as a teacher. There certainly hasn't been a lot of grammar in our own primary and secondary schooling, the last few generations of schooling. So therefore, when students ask tricky questions like, oh, why do I have to write that? Why do I have to put a comma here? Or why can't I keep going with this sentence? You can be left in the dark and be like, oh, I don't know, just cause. And then you feel like,
so.
Because Natalie told me to do it. Or here's a paragraph I found that it does it. I don't know why it does it, but it does. And so you miss out on that rich conversation where you can be like, oh, that's interesting. It looks like it should have something there, but really, in this example sentence, it doesn't require a comma. People get confused about when to put commas when you've got subordinate conjunctions, for example, like because and unless and if. You have the support, you have the comma when that part of the sentence is at the front. So because he didn't want to forget his lines, comma, James read from the script. But if you put it at the end of the sentence, you don't need that comma. James read from the script because he didn't want to forget his lines. So there's a simple convention there about how that works, and but people make mistakes in that space all the time, even teachers, because they haven't actually learned that rule, which actually makes your sentence clearer and easier to understand, which is the whole point of writing, is to be better at communication.
Yeah, okay. I want to explore one of your points, Nathaniel, and
yeah, sure.
I want to go back to how you're talking about secondary schools when it comes to writing, because
yeah.
I find writing often similar, making the connection back to maths, that if you miss the foundations, it only gets harder because you don't have the foundations there. That leads to confusion, that leads to disengagement, that leads to the different mindsets that we have. What do you think is important for teachers within the writing space? You know, what does a good writing program look like, without going into the nitty-gritty of the content? We have our syllabuses there to inform that.
Yeah.
But if I'm looking at my writing program, what are your kind of non-negotiables? Obviously it's linked to the syllabus and the contents there, but what are the other kind of non-negotiables a part of a great writing program?
Sure. So I think we know a lot about how complex writing is now, and you know that anecdotally as a teacher, and how you could cut it in many different ways. I think most of the time, writing programs that are currently available, some of them good and some of them not so good, they basically cut it up at the text level, and they'll say, well, this is what a narrative looks like, this is what an informative or an expository looks like, this is what a persuasive looks like. These are the kinds of things that writers will do, and there's heaps of content there, so you can spend your whole primary and secondary schooling looking at that stuff. What some writing programs miss out on is the bits in between. So say there's programs that look at the parts of a narrative, and they talk about building to, you know, that have an orientation, and they build to like a climax, and then it sort of then peters out again, and this sort of resolution sort of idea. And that's really important. That's called story grammar. Really important that students understand how stories work and the bits and pieces that they need. But if you've got a student who doesn't know how to put sentences together in a way that makes sense, or doesn't know how to manipulate the language so it's not the same kind of sentence again and again and again, then that narrative is never going to be any good if it's just at that sort of text-based level that you're looking at as a teacher. So you find yourself giving copious feedback and being like, okay, you really need to have done this, and you need to have done this, and this is, sentence isn't good. And you feel bad about how much feedback you're putting on the paper for a year six or a year seven sort of essay or story, because you're just finding mistakes on every single line. So then that tells you that there might be some sub skills or some sub goals that you could incorporate in your writing. And, you know, whether you're following a strict program or whether you're just trying to get, you know, to develop your own sort of approach that harnesses some of those, that knowledge about, you know, not overwhelming students and knowing how to break things down and to pick up on errors and then make that a focus for the next day. You could lean into those errors and think, well, I need to understand what's going on here. Why are there so many students that are doing X or doing Y? So good writing programs won't just look at the whole picture. They won't look at just the text level. They'll actually go deeper and say, well, there may well be students in year six or year seven, for example, that haven't yet mastered how to get sentences to work for them, haven't got very interesting sentences. They might have, just very simple ones like James read from the script. James opened up his book. James then, and it's just the same sentence again and again. They don't know how to mix it up with a, you know, different sentence type, or to put a subordinate conjunction in there to make it more interesting. So unless, or if, or whenever, or something like that. So a great writing approach will make sure that those component parts that make up the text actually have some airing. So, and it's okay to spend some of your writing sessions just getting those single or two sentences really, really good, because the difficulty with writing once you've mastered some of those sentences is not just the grammar, it's actually about what you're writing about. And so often our students are overwhelmed because they don't know what they want to say, let alone how they want to write it. So if you help students to articulate their ideas and to make strong connections between their writing as a form of thinking as well, then you get sort of the best of both worlds. They're getting good at expressing themselves with grammar, but then they've actually got something to say at the other end because they've learned about some cool stuff. They've formed their opinions. They know how to organize their ideas. And then, you know, paragraph structure is really important after you get the sentence level working. So how do you decide what's a topic sentence versus what's not? How do you order your ideas into a logical sequence? All of that is so important as well.
can I go on a random tangent? when we're talking about like those things like, you know, maths and all those other areas, I guess we know that, you know, reading and writing is that natural reciprocal sort of approach. You know, if we can read it, we can write it. If we can write it, theoretically, we should be able to read it. Technically. Do you think there's anything else that links nicely that way with writing? I suppose because if you're thinking of those kids that have an apprehension towards writing, and we assume, well, let's enhance the reading skills, that will therefore make writing a bit easier to approach. Is there another approach, I suppose, that's beneficial?
So I think some students get overwhelmed with writing, and in this conversation we're tending to talk about the older kids, which is absolutely fine because this is when it starts to really fall apart, and you know, end of primary school, start of secondary for some students. In many ways, you can take the heat out of the situation in terms of like, okay, we're going to do some writing now. Everyone groans and everyone sort of goes, oh no, not writing. Like that's so hard. I'd prefer to just make a PowerPoint or something, you know. You can take some of the heat out of that by doing very low stakes writing in any subject. So if you're a PE teacher, if you're a maths teacher, if you're a music teacher, science, humanities, you are going to be talking about something. So therefore you could also be writing about something. So turn and talks or pair shares are really popular in classrooms, and they're really useful ways of helping students to share their ideas before they then, you know, share them in front of the class. You can do the same kind of work or the same kind of prompts with a short sentence response, for example. Mini whiteboards are really handy for this. So getting students actually not just saying it to their partner, but then write down what you've got on your whiteboard and I want a full sentence. And if they can't do a full sentence off the top of their head, you could give them the sentence starter or give them the start of the sentence. And that's still a valuable and important writing task that then, you know, if you do that regularly in whatever subject, you've suddenly given them practice to create the component pieces of a paragraph or create the component pieces of a full text later on. So those low stakes sort of questions that you can embed in any subject actually allow you to think, well, writing is something that we're going to do all the time. I think back to my own schooling and thinking probably how little actual writing I did. I probably did a lot of listening and probably did attempted at note taking and things like that sometimes, depending on how much the teacher liked to lecture, for example. But there was a lot of probably a lot of discussion, but not without a lot of recording of what that discussion was. So whether you write it on the whiteboard because it's a quick low stakes task, or whether you actually also have a practice in your classroom to get that into the book as well, even as low stakes sentence writing or, you know, very brief paragraph planning. Some paragraphs you don't even have to write. You can just, the process of planning the paragraph and having a killer topic sentence with some dot points underneath of what you might actually cover in that paragraph, that alone is useful for crafting thinking and developing learning. And I think you're right, Beck, you can get really good at using writing as a tool for thinking, but then you can also use those content areas to practice writing in a low stakes way and build up to those larger tasks. Because it's intimidating and intimidating for teachers to think about how do I teach, you know, science teachers, how do I teach them how to write a lab report? Like that's, you know, so complicated to get that right and to get the formality of it right. Well, the way that I would be doing it is to break that task down into the many different components and embed those little pieces, those little bits of the whole picture of a lab report into bite-sized tasks that you're doing with your students every single lesson. So today we're going to look at this part of the experiment. You're going to go off and do that experiment. When you come back, you're going to write up just two sentences about that. And they're going to fit a particular structure. Maybe we're trying to include particular vocabulary. Maybe we're trying to ensure that our language is formal, so it's not colloquial because we're writing like scientists. But whatever it is, you can embed writing as an outcome as well as a tool for learning in any subject.
Yeah, and I think that's...
Go, James.
No, I was just, you know, talking about how you were saying that integration through the other key learning areas. And we're so fortunate within primary school that we have our class for the majority of the time. So talking about that transference, whatever that skill that you're focusing on, your explicit writing lessons, how can you transfer that focus within the other key learning areas when writing's a part of everything? I think that's a key point. Sorry, Beck.
No, I think it's just, I guess, giving teachers the freedom to say you can adapt and modify and choose from those wide variety of things. Because as soon as you said, like, how do we teach the kids to write a lab report, do those science teachers actually have those requirements around that comma goes there, or it's just like, we just need the data, we just need the facts. So it's I guess the kids need to know as well too, is that that rigid approach around language conventions, those rules and things that we have, it's where's the priority at the time, I suppose. And that's, I know that's as kids get older and stuff, when they hit all those science lessons, my older two are in high school at the moment, and I'm looking at that stuff and being like, right, yep, it's a different sphere. It's a different sphere. It's not the same. So I guess that kind of links nicely with another question that we had, which is, what can we learn from linguistics to improve writing teaching? Because, like, if we really want to get to the core of language, there's some really interesting research out there about how language has evolved over time and how linguistics culturally, socially impacts everything that we do with how we communicate, how we talk, how we write. So I'd love to hear your insights on that.
So linguistics is a really rich field. I was very lucky that it was my first major in my degree before I did teaching. And I got into linguistics, I think, because I studied a second language. I did Japanese, and I was fascinated by that language and the fact that it helped me reflect on my own language. And when I got to university, I did Japanese and linguistics and realized that Japanese was really hard, and that I couldn't remember all of the characters or the kanji that I needed to. And so I really had to think ask some hard questions and think, well, why am I doing this? Is it because I really love the language and I want to go and spend time in Japan, or is it actually because I love language in general? And I found that studying linguistics opened up my world to thinking in that way and thinking about language as a, you know, this incredible human invention. So linguistics has a lot to offer because there's a rich history of humans investigating our own language. Language is an interesting one because, as I mentioned before, it's something that's been with us for hundreds of thousands of years, but we have only started writing it down in the last 5,000 or 6,000. So as a result, languages are fluid, are constantly evolving. I don't know if anyone else watches, like, what's the new word of the year? They'll sort of announce it on Twitter sometimes. They'll say there's a new word, essentially, and the dictionaries will decide what their favorite entry is. And there's actually hundreds of new words every year that get invented or coined or produced, depending on what is I guess popular in the time.
And not counted as slang, like it's counted as a proper word in our language.
Yeah, so great question. But interestingly, linguists, the people who study language, don't actually discriminate much between slang and actual language. So, you know, the idea of, like, there's formal language and there's informal language is somewhat arbitrary, meaning that it doesn't, over time, most things that start off as slang become accepted. So things that you would never say years ago, I don't know, the word cool has been around for a long time, but obviously to say cool in the sense of that's awesome is very commonly accepted in conversation. You probably wouldn't write cool in an essay unless you're talking about popular culture or something and having to use that as a technical term about what people think is cool. But the idea that cool event originally didn't have that meaning and would never have been put into the dictionary with that meaning. But at some point, enough people started using it that way that it stopped being just a random thing that a subculture was using. So a bit of slang, for example, or a colloquialism, into something that's pretty much accepted. Most people across society in English-speaking countries, many English-speaking countries around the world, will say cool quite a bit because it's quite a useful word to say something about what we think about something, so our opinions of it. So interestingly, what we write about sometimes is a bit slow in terms of catching up because our oral language actually develops a lot faster and moves a lot faster. So words will be added all the time to our language. Grammatical things will change in our language, and especially different dialects of English have different grammatical patterns that are acceptable as well. And the old school view of, like, grammar and, like, what you must learn and you must speak in a certain way is pretty it's not really accepted a lot in educational linguistic circles anymore. The idea is that it's actually a linguistic relativism. So it doesn't matter so much how you're using language as long as enough people are using it. You're not gonna break any rules if the basically the norm becomes the new rule. So there are some really important things about language that haven't changed and that will not change necessarily. And you're not going to start seeing sort of random sort of additions into our grammar, for example, which is why when we read a formal piece of writing, there's certain things that we expect, and there's certain things that are a bit jarring when we read them and think, oh, like, that's not right. And that's because written language does evolve in a more slow fashion, and it does require more conventions than, say, conversational English or conversational language, which is a bit more informal. So some of the things we expect when people write is that they write in full sentences, and that they use punctuation. We expect that an essay, for example, will give some sort of orientation. It won't launch straight into the body of the essay and sort of stand there randomly or end on a strange note that's unresolved. Same as a story. Like, there's many ways to manipulate and to change a story, but stories conventionally, and, you know, and I think they'll continue to have this, they do have somewhere that they begin. They have various characters and plot points and tension and drama and things like that, but eventually they do end, and they tend to end with an ending. They don't sort of end abruptly, unless you really wanted to satisfy your reader and not sell a lot of books. So written language is more conventional, and there are more rules involved with it, which is why school-based teaching of writing does mean teaching students those conventions. And not because I think as a linguist, I'd say it's not that it's any more superior than someone else's form of writing or someone else's form of speaking, which might be completely different and follow some different rules. But it's because certain conventions are required in certain contexts in our society. So if you wrote a job application in the way that you have a chat to your friend at a cafe, for example, being like, oh yeah, I was thinking of applying for this job. It's pretty cool, like, you know, a bit of a challenge. Notice I've got a lot of half finished sentences there. Like, you wouldn't see like, oh, like, yeah, a bit of a like challenge, like, you know, you wouldn't be like, oh, I thought I'd do this, but I'm not sure. Like, if someone wrote that down and submitted it as an application, that would go straight in the bin. Like, there's rules about how writing happens in certain contexts. And it's really for the purpose of clarity, I think, is that people want to pick something up. It follows the conventions. They can understand what it is. They understand what the writer is trying to say, and they're sort of, it's working as a communication device. But interestingly, written language is also starting to evolve a lot because of the use of written language so quickly in short messages. So if you've ever read like letters that are written up in a novel you might have read, or actually put your hands on an old letter in the way that they used to write to each other in the 19th century or earlier, for example, it is incredibly formal and incredibly conventional in the way that they sort of put lots of things in. They have to remark on the weather. They have to include the correct salutation. The punctuation is immaculate. You know, people writing those letters would spend hours crafting them and thinking of the perfect way to frame something up. Nowadays, written communication can be so instantaneous that it's just like speaking. So when you're texting someone, or when you're in an instant messaging situation, like on Teams or on whatever the other equivalents are, for example, you could be literally writing the way that you're speaking. So sometimes this is something interesting that I have learned as someone who's older. Like, I'm feeling old now, but it's amazing because you're working with 20-year-olds, you start to feel old because they're saying things you don't understand. But my undergraduate students tell me that if you send a text message with a full stop on the end, it means that you are really upset at that person.
Well, the thumbs up apparently is supposed to be like, yeah, champ, kind of. That's the interpretation.
It's like daggy, is it?
I'm
doing thumbs up left, right, and center back, so I'm completely out of it.
But you can see that too, just the fact that text language, you can't infer, you can't detect sarcasm as well or anything like that. And it's probably because it is so much shorter, you're not tagging on to the end going, you know, well, back in the day, just jokes, you know, JKS, like, showing my age now.
Probably not using it anymore. Yeah, exactly. Or LOL, like LOL has probably starting to be phased out. Well, that one's pretty prolific in some circles still. But, you know, using emojis and stuff instead of sort of writing as well. So apparently the use of punctuation, the conventions around texting is really, really different, and, you know, different to other forms of writing, obviously, because it does mimic more like it is like you'd speak to someone, because you can literally be typing or speaking at the same time via that app and going back and forth in almost not exactly as quickly as spoken language, but almost as quickly, and as a result it's faster, it's quicker, it's less sort of formal. I think if you wrote something and said like, "Dear Rebecca," in a text message, and then outlined a whole lot of things with full punctuation and then signed it off, "Regards, Nathaniel," I think someone would think you're pretty strange the way that you've written that text message, or Rebecca's either, you know, in a lot of trouble, or has somehow been sent an email in the form of a text message, because that's just not how you do texts. So to go back to your question, though, like linguistics has so much to offer teachers who are thinking about teaching writing, because linguistics gives us a language for talking about language. When we're working with students and they're making really interesting but, you know, unhelpful errors in the way that they're forming their sentences or putting their paragraphs together, or, you know, they might not know that the sentence is incomplete. There's this thing called a fragment where they've done a bit of a sentence. You know, the example I did before was like, I kind of thought of, you know, that sort of thing. Like that sentence is a fragment because it's missing a subject, and all sentences need a subject as a predicate, as we said before. So when you've got that language, when you've got that understanding of some of the conventions and the names that we give those conventions, it actually can change the way that you can talk to your students about what they're doing. You don't have to just say, nah, that's not how I would do it. That's wrong or that's incorrect. You can actually give them the tools to break it apart and say, well, this is why this sentence is correct and this one's not correct. This one's missing the predicate, for example. Or this sentence here has a verb in it, but this verb is not doesn't have the right tense. So let's change the end of that verb so that it matches properly and so it doesn't sound awkward, for example. I'm guessing we'll cut this little bit of the recording out because he's dropped off.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's not going to ruin the recording, because it's still, I think.
If it's recording to the cloud, it won't be a problem.
Yeah, it should be. Should be,
yeah,
doing
it looks
that.
Fine. Yeah.
I don't know what happened to him, but it's brought us to the end of our questions anyway. So just in case he can't come back,
you can do a round final, it out. Sort of round there. Out. Yeah. No worries.
That's it. So thank you so much for your insights. I think it's definitely giving us something to think about. And I like the fact that some of the stuff we touched on today is definitely something that a beginning teacher can sort of absorb and take into account. But I suppose if you're a more experienced teacher out there that's got into a groove with teaching writing, and you might have had some new things tonight that make you think, I can have a go at maybe thinking a bit differently about how I approach this in the classroom. I hope this has been helpful for you. I think key takeaways today for me is just I really don't think I have much knowledge on linguistics specifically. Like I did the tokenistic one subject, you know, at uni I did Japanese as well too. And when I was in high school, I did like a 2-week student exchange, and just being immersed in another language just really makes you appreciate the meaning behind things and the approach to how you do and say things. And even sometimes I suppose that cultural aspect and societal respect around how you address people, key phrases. So, you know, when you've got that more formal language and who you speak to in that language as opposed to your friend, you know, in some ways there can be such drastic differences between things like that and how those languages evolve over time. So even when you think of all the words that are embedded in our language that have come from another culture, so many French and Latin and everything that's there, I'm actually thinking maybe I need to learn more on that to get that deeper understanding of why our language is the way that it is, because English is stupid. It's the language that breaks its own rules constantly, but I think it's also because it's so heavily tied in its history and its evolution and
very rich and a language. It's full on. Yeah.
Yeah, and like you said, it just keeps changing. So I got given a book for Christmas that was all about the story of how the Oxford English Dictionary was made. I know Mel Gibson did a movie and I watched on Netflix. But just the little stories of all of these people in society going out and coming back and contributing to what that language looks like. So, yeah, I've honed in on linguistics, and I think that's something that I'm going to take away from tonight. So I really appreciate you working on that. So thank you, Dr. Nathaniel Swain. Is there any way that any of our listeners can get in touch with you, or any kind of any promos that you want to shout out for while we've got you?
Well, since you ask, we've actually got an exciting course at La Trobe, which is a short course for 4 weeks, and it's completely online, so anyone can take it anytime. We have live sessions, but it's also recorded, and the whole topic is on the linguistics of writing. So if you are a teacher and you're thinking, oh, this could be something I could get my head into, this could help my understanding of how to teach writing and how to support my writers in the classroom, but also get better at your own writing as well, these short courses are available very soon in the next few weeks. You can jump onto the La Trobe website and find it. We'll also share the link with the team at the podcast as well. So two short courses in writing that are coming up. One's on the linguistics of writing and one's on the science of teaching writing.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. We'll wrap it up there. So anyone listening, we look forward to seeing you in the next episode. If you've got any suggestions, feel free to hit us up on the socials on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we'll see you for the next episode. Thanks, everyone. Bye.